everyone. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Maria Wilton. You might know my in-laws, Jill and Paul. And you might know my husband, Dan, who was the one speaking this morning at the service. We're really pleased to be able to be here and to give something back to a church that's really blessed us so much. So I've been allowed to choose my own passage today, and so I'm giving you something that I've been looking forward to preaching on for ages. And I hope by the end of this evening, you'll agree with me that this passage is not as boring as it looks at first glance. It's actually really exciting and changes the way we think about Jesus. That passage, I hope you've already spotted, is on your tables. We're looking at Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 to 17, which is the family tree of Jesus. I've got another big copy here as well. People skip this because they think it's boring. But today we're going to have to take a really close look. What we're going to do is I'm going to talk in three parts with gaps in between. And in the parts where I'm talking, you guys will be talking too. I'll be asking you questions to get you talking around your tables. And speaking of which, we're going to start with that. What I'd like you guys to do is get the genealogies and get some of those highlighters that have been left out for you. And I want you to talk around the table about who do you recognize on this list of names and highlight them. If you don't know but someone next to you does, they should tell you. Tell each other who these people are, why you recognize them, and highlight them. Off you go. I'll give you a few minutes. Done. You ready? Is that enough time? Yeah? Okay. Now, these names, I spent an afternoon looking through the Old Testament, and 36 of these people are mentioned in the Old Testament. Anyone found 36? Good, because a lot of them are only mentioned in other family trees, so you'd be pretty boring if you had that memorized. A good score is probably about 9 of them. But are we on that sort of level? About 9 of them is probably about normal for someone who's kind of read the Bible through a couple of times. Yeah? It's not a bragging game, Simon. It's not a bragging game. So, actually, though, Matthew tells us we actually only need 2 names to be familiar with for us to really get what he's saying here. He tells us right up at the top of the page. This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham and David are really interesting when it comes to genealogies, because they're the only two people that God makes a promise to that regards descendants. If you're in a genealogy with those two in it, you're the descendant. The promise applies to you. So, those promises. Abraham's promise is really, really well known. So I'm going to ask you guys, what does God promise Abraham? In a simple sort of Sunday club level. Sunday, what do you tell the kids in Sunday school? Father of many nations. So he's going to have, even though he's elderly, he's going to be the ancestor of many children, many great grandchildren, and so on. What's the next thing he says? Yeah, there'll be more of those children than there are stars in the sky. What else does he say? Come on, something about where he is. His descendants will go back there. Promised land. He's going to give them the promised land. And there's one third thing that God says. Anyone got it? Yeah, Dan's got it. He's probably read my notes. He says that I will be your God and the God of your descendants, and through your descendants I will bless all the nations of the earth. Okay. I'm not going to make you tell me David's one, because his one's a little bit more obscure. It's not taking up most of Genesis like Abraham's one. David's one is in 2 Samuel chapter 7. And at this point, David's looking to maybe build a temple for God. And this is where God comes in and makes him a promise. God says, "When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever." And God makes good on his promise. Let's look at the family tree. Here's David. In the genealogy you've got there, he's the only one that Matthew calls king. But that's just because he's the first. His son Solomon then becomes king, and he's the one who builds the temple. If those of you highlighted his name, you'll know that one. And then his son Rehoboam becomes king, and then his son Abijah becomes king, and so on and so on and so on and so on and so on. For 14 generations, father to son becomes king. Until we get to Jeconiah. Where is he? Here he is. Until we get to this fella. His son is not king. And Matthew tells us why in the genealogy. You've got it there. It's on the second row. Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon. So what happened was the kings were ruling this kingdom, and then the empire, the huge empire next door, the Babylonian Empire, saw them and went in, invaded, carried off loads of people, including the king and the king's brothers, one at a time, carried them off and took them to Babylon. And so the king can't rule. He's been carried away, and his descendants can't rule. They're living far from home, and now David's throne is empty. God's promise was cut short. And there's not a king in Israel again for generations. Because even when the people in Babylon get to come back home, there's still other powers in charge, other empires and other powers are just fighting over it. And they never get to be kings again, these descendants of David. And 200 years later, when Matthew's writing this, there still isn't a Davidic king. So, when Matthew tells us that Jesus is the son of David and the son of Abraham, he is reminding us that the Old Testament ended on a cliffhanger. We're still waiting for these unfulfilled promises. He's promised that the throne of David will have a king on it forever. And there's that elusive mission to all nations that we still haven't seen fulfilled. I'm going to give you a few minutes to have a break, and we're going to listen to a video that Simon's found, the one he said we'd want to wash over us like water. I'll be back in a minute for the second of three parts, in which I will make Christmas changed forever for you. Okay. The next bit, I want you to get back with your table again, because this is the very first thing that happens in Matthew's gospel, but it's important to see what Matthew writes about next. So what I'd like to do is, if anyone's got a Bible with them or maybe on their phone, have a look and see what happens in the rest of chapter 1 and chapter 2 and summarize it so everyone at the table is aware of what it is. Okay, so up to the end of chapter 2. King Herod, yeah? Okay. I picked up a book to research this and I found something really exciting, and I'm really looking forward to sharing this one. It suggested that we compare the genealogy of Jesus with the genealogy of King Herod, who you've just been reminded of, the guy who is king at the time when Jesus is born. So I did something I've never really done before and did some research into King Herod. Turns out it's really interesting. I actually can't fit it all in. If you want to come learn about it afterwards, come find me, because I've got more to say. So I'm going to give you the potted version. Well, the first thing you find when you try and look at his family tree is that he never published one, which is a little bit odd for a king of this time period to not make public his grand ancestors. But he had a court historian, a man who worked for him, called Nicolaus of Damascus, and he had a reason. Okay, so the reason that King Herod doesn't give his genealogy and make it public, it's because, you know, that time I was talking about earlier when people got carried away to Babylon and then they got allowed to come home again? Well, when his ancestors got carried off and came home again, when everyone came home, they wrote down who was home and recorded their family trees. But you know what? Herod's ancestors didn't actually come home. They moved in somewhere else. So the reason they're not in the records is because they didn't come back. That's what the man paid by Herod says, is the story. But there's another historian who was living at the same time as King Herod and the historian Nicolaus of Damascus, and he calls it fake news. Josephus, a name you might be familiar with if you've done some reading around the New Testament time period, because he's a well-respected historian, he tells a different story. Josephus says the truth is Herod is embarrassed by his family tree because his father and all his ancestors were from the Edomite tribe. So the Edomite tribe, they live right next door to the Israelites, and they actually share the first two ancestors with the Israelites. But then, instead of being born of Jacob, they're the descendants of his twin brother Esau. So far, so good. They're just a neighboring tribe. But the problem is, if you recognize the word Edomite from the Bible, you might recognize it from the prophets. They don't have nice things to say about the Edomites. So again, back to that time people were carried off and taken to Babylon. The Edomites lived next door, and they had a choice whether they were going to help the Israelites to defend themselves or not. Not only did they not help, they rushed in and did some raiding of their own, pillaged and stole from the Israelites while they were already under attack. As you can imagine, Israelites were very slow to forgive that. And you'll find nasty things said about the Edomites in Malachi, Ezekiel, Isaiah, Amos, Jeremiah, and the entire book of Obadiah. So Herod is descended from these people who are hated still by the Israelites. How does he end up as king of Judea? So, summarized for brevity, the Romans had started ruling the region behind the scenes through Herod's father, a man named Antipater. They were pretending to let the weak local kings kind of act like they were ruling, but really the Romans were pulling the strings with Antipater's help. And eventually, when this became more hassle than it was worth, the Roman Senate decided that instead of supporting one of these fake kings, they'd turn Herod into a king and rule for them. Herod became king because the Roman Senate thought it would be useful. He hasn't got any right to rule. He hasn't got any royal ancestry. He's a local minor governor from the wrong tribe. He's not even Antipater's oldest son. So, with that in mind, go back to the Christmas story of the wise men. It's suddenly so much more dramatic because Herod's got this throne. It's on shaky foundations, and he's a bit worried having to look after it and protect it, and he knows the people don't like him. And then he hears there's another king out there, a threat. And then his people tell him, "Ah, it's probably born in Bethlehem." It's what? It's probably from the promised line of David that the people have been awaiting and hoping for and is the fulfillment of all their wishes for 200 years. This is a huge threat to Herod. This genealogy is not just some boring list. This is a threat to Herod. And to Jews, this is forbidden knowledge, a claim that there's an alternative out there. Another rule, a rightful rule, that God will answer the prayers. So look at the copies I've given you again. There's that stuff at the very, very bottom that's like about 14 generations of this, 14 generations of that. It's pretty much gibberish to us, but to the Jews who thought a lot about significant numbers, they would have seen 14 as being twice seven, and seven's like 7 days of creation, it's perfect, and this is doubly perfect. And all we need to know is that every 14 generations, God does something. So 14 generations between Abraham and David, and then he does something, he puts in a king. And then 14 generations, and then they get taken into exile. And then another 14 generations, and we have Jesus. So all these other descendants weren't candidates to be king in the way Jesus was, because the time wasn't ready. But now, Matthew is saying, now is the time. Now is the time. God says something new. Now is the time for the earthly powers to be worried because the king is coming. The covenant will be answered. The promise will be fulfilled. Here comes the king. Of course, you and I are not living in the time of Herod. We know something that he didn't, and we know that this king is not just a threat to earthly kings. This is the King of Kings. And most of us here today are here because we have accepted this king as our king. And the band have prepared a song that we can sing to our king. And I want to invite you guys to stand if you'd like to and sing it. And then I'll be back with part 3. We've looked at kind of the bigger picture of the genealogy. Now I want us to look at some of the little details of the who's who in this thing. Question for everyone. What's unusual about this genealogy? You've looked at it. Have another look. What's Matthew added that isn't strictly necessary?
Women.
Women. Not that women aren't strictly necessary, Lauren. No, but you see, at the time when he was writing, they didn't think about it as biology like we would, so you do the mums as well in the family tree. They're kind of writing about inheritance, so they don't record the women. Even when some of these guys have multiple wives, and therefore it could be the son of any one of them, the women aren't in there. So the fact Matthew has included them means he's trying to tell us something. He's deliberately added them. He hasn't added all of them. He's not just being a feminist. He's picked some very specific women. So, Dan, would you mind coming and sticking the women up for me? Oh, sorry, no, the blue tank's gone missing. You're going to be there 10 minutes if you hold them. You can find the blue tank, it's in my bag, sorry. So, there's some women in this list who shouldn't be there. Why has he put them in there? Why has he chosen these four, if you don't include Mary, four women? Tamar, Ruth, Rahab, and someone he calls the wife of Uriah. What's her actual name? This table's fast. Bathsheba. Okay. I'm going to talk to you guys about the first of these women, Tamar, because her story isn't so well known as the other three. And it's probably not so well known because it's a little bit X-rated. We have got children here. I'm going to make this as PG as possible. So Tamar is found in Genesis chapter 38, if you want to read it later for yourself. So we've got to start with this man called Judah. Okay, Judah is a... You're very distracting, apparently, Dan. Judah is one of the brothers of Joseph, the guy with the technicolor dream coat. Yeah? And when he's looking for a wife for his eldest son, he finds a woman called Tamar to marry his son, but the problem is, dies before he has any children with Tamar. So Judah goes to his second son and says, "Oh man, will you marry Tamar?" This is crazy from our perspective. So let's take a second and think how it looks in the ancient world. Okay, we're talking about a time period where women don't own anything. You don't have a business. You don't have a bank account. All you have is a husband or a son who owns things. All right? So if you don't have a man in this time period, you will be destitute. When your father dies, you're homeless if you don't have a husband. And if your husband dies, you're homeless if you don't have a son who can inherit from the father or the grandfather. So when a man says to a woman, "You can marry my son," he's saying, "My family have got you now. We're going to look after you and be your security." All right? So when his first son, dies, Judah knows it's his responsibility to look after his daughter-in-law, Tamar. So that's why he says, "Oh, man, you'd better marry her because we've got to look after her. We promised her that." So Oman marries Tamar. But the same thing happens again, and Omar dies without giving any children to Tamar. So Judah does have one more son. He's a bit young. And the thing is, Judah's beginning to worry that Tamar is bad luck. So he says to Tamar, "Yeah, okay, you can marry Sheila, but not yet. He's still young. Go live with your dad for a few years. Don't call us, we'll call you." He has no intention of letting her marry his youngest son. Even though Tamar's security is his responsibility, he's washed his hands of her. And eventually, Tamar realizes what's happened. She's been left. And she doesn't have any other means. She can't rely on benefits. She can't rely on any other help. But she's had that promise made to her that she will inherit from Judah's family through her sons. So she goes about finding a way to get what has been promised to her. she puts on a veil, disguises herself as a temple prostitute. And then she goes to wait where she knows Judah will go when he's going to come shear his sheep. Judah comes along. He doesn't recognize her, even though it's his own daughter-in-law, so it's a good disguise. He doesn't recognize her. He sees a prostitute, a temple prostitute. So in one act, he commits adultery and idolatry. Now, apparently, Judah isn't carrying enough cash, so he gives a security deposit, promising that he's going to come pay her later. So he takes off the signet ring sort of thing, that's a necklace that he would have worn, and he takes his staff and he gives them to Tamar. So I'll get them back when I pay you. He tries to pay her and he can't find her. Where's the prostitute gone? What prostitute? No one else has seen her. But Tamar's plan has worked. She's pregnant. Unfortunately, she couldn't hide it for long. And everyone's slightly suspicious that even though her husband has been dead for years, she's up the duff. When they tell Judah, his response to hearing that his daughter-in-law is pregnant is, to quote the Bible, what Judah says is, "Let her be burned to death." But Tamar is ready. She's got that signet ring and the staff that Judah gave her. So she says, "The man who fathered my baby gave me these." Judah recognizes his own staff and his own necklace and says, "All right, we'll let you live. In fact, you've actually done the right thing because I promised you it and you just made sure that I had to give it to you. Yeah, all right, Tamar, that child is my heir." Well, heirs, turns out it's twins. All right, so that's Tamar, the first of the women mentioned in this genealogy. What I'd like you guys to do is, I hope that on each table, you guys will recognize the rest of these names: Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba. You don't need to go into as much detail as I did. Just make sure everyone at your table knows, who is that? What are they famous for? Just the main point. If anyone is stuck, doesn't know who they are, give me a wave and I'll come tell you where to find them in the Bible. All right? Three names. Off you go. So, of all the people in the Bible that Matthew could draw attention to, all the people in the genealogy, all the good upstanding people in the Bible, he has chosen these four. If this was your family tree, would you draw attention to these people? Would these have been the stories you told earlier? I wouldn't. Like, Rahab is brave, right? She's got a really dirty past. Tamar, deceptive, kind of scandalous. Ruth, yeah, good, but like, she's a poverty-stricken refugee. And Bathsheba, don't get us started, because like, she's either a temptress or some sort of coerced victim. So Matthew has put these in for a reason. And the commentaries I was reading gave loads of different reasons. If you want to come talk, I'll tell you some of the others. But you know what? I think what we really are supposed to learn from this today is about that scandal, about the fact that we don't want these women in this. Because this is a list of really great people and really great heroes, right? We looked at them at the beginning. You're probably remembering all the epic battles and things, and that's what stands out to you. And, oh, Abraham's faith. And, you know, this is a list of heroes, and Jesus descended from this list of great men, fathers of the faith. But by adding these women into the genealogy, Matthew forces us to remember the sordid details of the men listed with them. So David was a great king. He was a hero, a giant slayer, a psalm writer. But he did make a huge mistake with Bathsheba. He had temptation and he allowed himself to go from there into adultery and from adultery into murder. Matthew is so blatant about this. He says Uriah's wife in order to force us to acknowledge the fact that, yeah, she's David's wife, but only after David gets Uriah killed. And Tamar reminds us that Judah, one of these heads of the 12 tribes of Israel, is a liar, slept with a prostitute, impregnated his daughter-in-law. Matthew doesn't let us have great people. He doesn't let us forget who these people are. They're not perfect people. They're not special people. We're not to idolize them, and we're not to say that Jesus comes of some people that are special and different to us. Jesus is born from sinners and victims. Matthew wants us to remember how bad Jesus' family tree was, because these people are normal. They're like us. They've got their good points, and at times they really fail. They're broken people with sometimes broken stories. But you know what? God loves that. He doesn't love that we're broken. He loves to heal brokenness. He loves to redeem brokenness. He loves to produce something beautiful out of something ugly. And these ugly stories are the manure in which he grows the beautiful vine of salvation. This is all about poverty, struggle, the grief of being widowed, the bloodiness of war, affairs and trickery, injustice and murder. And yet God takes all of those ugly things, all these terrible dark things, and turns them for the good. That's what Matthew wants to tell us right before he tells us anything else about Jesus. God doesn't shy away from people like us. And they have always been part of his plan, and we are still a part of his plan, no matter who we are and what we've done and what we're still struggling with. Jesus came on behalf of sinners, being born of sinners, that he might destroy the sins of all. I'm going to hand back to Simon.